Hello, and welcome to Endeavors. On today's show, I'll be speaking with wrestler, musician, and actor Chris Jericho, as well as filmmaker Jennifer Peedham. That's today on Endeavors.
Personified, and I will drag you down and sell you out. Run away. I am cold like December snow. I have carved out this soul made of stone, and I will drag.
Song Judas by the band Fozzy. It's true that the band might not be super well known, you know, to those who probably aren't heavy metal or hard rock fans. But if you're of a certain age and of a certain era, you've probably heard of its lead singer. In addition to being a rock star, he's also an actor. But Chris Jericho is definitely most well known as a professional wrestler. And although his most famous time came with World Wrestling Entertainment, WWE, formerly the WWF, he's also wrestled with ECW, WCW, and New Japan Pro Wrestling. Between the three North American promotions, he's won 32 championships, including the WCW World Championship twice and WWE's World Heavyweight Championship three times. But he was also the WWE's ninth Triple Crown winner and fourth Grand Slam champion, and he was inducted into its Hall of Fame in 2010. When he was with that promotion, his, you know, because they all have characters, they all sort of personas. And the Chris Jericho, the character, the persona, I guess, was sort of an over-the-top rock star. So I guess it shouldn't come as a surprise that he's also one in real life. His band there that you heard, Fozzy, was formed in 1999. And that track, Judas, is the title track off their newest album, which is their seventh, and it came out last year. But he's also had a lot of other forays into TV. He was a contestant on Dancing with the Stars and on the only season of Celebrity Duets. And he's hosted the game show Downfall. And check this out, he hosted a robotics competition program called Robot Combat League, excuse me, and was a contributor to various VH1 shows. And appeared in one of the TV movies that has the best titles of all time, Android Apocalypse. But currently, he's delving into the world of comedy, and he has a web series on the CBC, the season two of which is out now, and it's called But I'm Chris Jericho. And I got to speak with him a few days ago about life after the WWE and all the different directions his career has gone in. This is me and Chris Jericho. Chris Jericho, hello, welcome to the show. How you doing, man?
Doing great, man. Thank you. Thank you so much.
So, is this true? I think it just came out today. Are you coming back for Raw 25?
I don't know. A lot of times the things happen that is news to me, so there's definitely nothing in place. So, I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine at this point. So, I guess I have to have a couple calls that I need to make to find out exactly what's going on.
Yeah. What do you make of the fact that now sort of news gets out there before the person who's the subject of the news might even be aware of it?
That happens quite often. And it's more often than you would think, especially like as someone in my position that has a lot of things going on. And I have a lot of, you know, not to sound pretentious, but I have a team. You have your team of people that your managers and your agents and those type of people. And sometimes things slip through the cracks. Well, I will read something online about maybe a Fozzy gig that we're playing or something going on with, you know, the Raw 25th anniversary. And I don't like that. You know, to me, I don't like anybody knowing my business before I know it. And then I'm the one who likes to decide whether or not I'll let people know about it, you know. But I think it's just kind of a necessary evil. It's just the way of the world nowadays with all the technology. Things get released. I mean, you'll see posters for Fozzy gigs at venues 3 weeks before it's released, or you'll see, you know, there's a lot of times I remember in the WWE, they'll put out a poster for a pay-per-view with your face on it that you didn't know about. Or I see merchandise all the time. There's still a famous story of the Chris Jericho bowling ball from about 2001 where I was at some autograph sign and some guy brought a bowling ball, like an official Chris Jericho bowling ball. I'm like, really? Like, I didn't know about any Chris Jericho bowling ball, and if I did know, I would want one. So there's more instances of that than you think, of people go, like, they don't send you one of these? It's like, no, there's a Chris Jericho coloring book that I had no idea even existed until somebody came up and wanted me to sign it. So it's not quite as organized as you might think sometimes when it comes to the overall, you know, knowledge of what's happening with yourself.
But this did just happen, and I know you were just in Japan. How did the whole wrestling in Japan come about for you?
Well, I mean, it's kind of interesting. Like, where are you located at? Where are you at right now?
Toronto.
Okay, so Toronto, so you're Canadian dude. So I grew up in Winnipeg, and Winnipeg is a great city, but there's not a lot of people that kind of came out of Winnipeg, you know, besides Burton Cummings and Neil Young and Chris Jericho and, you know, a few other stragglers here and there. So anyways, a couple of years ago, I started hearing about this guy who was really making waves in Japan, in New Japan Pro Wrestling, which is the biggest wrestling company in the world that's not WWE. And how much of a impact he was making, a huge star guy by the name of Kenny Omega. And he's from Winnipeg, which is very interesting, because anytime you hear somebody else from Winnipeg, you're automatically kind of a kindred spirit with that person. Oh, right on, another Winnipeg, congratulations. So he continued to kind of grow and make waves, headline the Tokyo Dome a couple times. And then another guy from Winnipeg by the name of Don Callis, who's been in the rest of the business for years, ended up getting the gig as a commentator there. He knows me, he knows Kenny, and he just called me one day and said, what do you think about Jericho and Omega at the Dome, the Tokyo Dome, this year? That was about six months ago. And I think he thought I was going to kind of laugh it off, but I didn't, because I thought, that's very interesting. It's almost like Mayweather and McGregor as far as a match you never thought was going to happen, just because it's two guys from two separate worlds, basically. But to me, I love the concept of it for that reason. And for the fact that we're both from Winnipeg, I just thought it was kind of a neat story. And that's basically where it all started. And once I agreed to it, and Kenny agreed to it, and New Japan was into it, and next thing you know, we're headlining the Tokyo Dome, Alpha versus Omega, and it's one of the biggest money-making matches of the year, and one of the biggest buzz about matches of the year, for all those reasons.
What do you make of this state of wrestling and sort of that form of entertainment today versus when you first joined up with WWE?
It's the same. You know, it's all show business, man. You know what I mean? And good versus evil, you know, and you go through different phases where there was the Attitude Era of a little bit more risque, a little more raunchy, and then it kind of went to the PG-13 era, which is a little more family-friendly, but it's all the same thing. You know, I can go to a movie that's rated R or a movie that's rated PG-13 and still enjoy it, because it doesn't have swearing in it or naked girls in it or whatever. So it's all show business, you know, and that's just the thing. I think in this day and age, especially for me, you know, wrestling is not my full focus at this point in time, and it hasn't been since 2010. I haven't been a full-time performer since then. So, you know, I'm kind of in the periphery. I still follow what's going on, but I'm not under contract to anybody. I can kind of go do whatever I want. If I want to do a match in Japan, I do it. If I decide to show up at the 25th anniversary, I do it. In the meantime, I still have, you know, Fozzy, which has the number one record, and Brian Chris Jericho, season two on CBC, the biggest network in Canada, with the super funny, hilarious original series, you know, anchored by Chris Jericho, playing Chris Jericho. So it's all entertainment, man. And that's one thing I find in this day an age that, you know, I used to say, if you work in the WWE show business boot camp, you learn a little bit about everything. So whether you want to go write a book after, or, you know, be a movie star, or make a record, or make a, you know, make a comedy series, you can do it, because we've learned it all from that background that we have of entertainment.
You mentioned this show, and I feel like you're kind of, you know, you're playing an exaggerated version of yourself. Is there a certain amount of maybe making fun of the ego and the macho-ness that is so often associated with wrestlers and that culture?
No, I don't think so. I think it's associated with Jericho. You know what I mean? I don't ever delve into stereotypes of what wrestling is or anything, because I've never been that. I've always just been me. You know, when I first started out, they said, you're too small to wrestle. I disagreed, and you know, here we are. So I always learned that I can have the biggest personality, the biggest charisma, and play the best character. And so, but I'm Chris Jericho, it's a lot of fun because I am playing an exaggerated version of myself. But it's also like the total prima donna who always gets it in the end. You know, it's almost like a modern-day Archie Bunker. Like, Archie Bunker is such a great character, such a jerk. But it really worked because at the end of the day, he always got screwed in the end and learned his lesson. And that's what I love about But I'm Chris Jericho. It's almost like a very Seinfeld-esque situation for me where, you know, I'm Chris Jericho playing Chris Jericho on the show Chris Jericho, but it's really not me. But there's elements of it that's me. But if you watch this show, such a pompous, over-exaggerated version, But it's fun. It's fun to play that. It's fun to play that prima donna side that we all have within us, but I get to play it, you know, and really go over the top of it. You know, and then you surround yourself with super talented, funny people, and then you gotta hit show. And it's one of those things. What character do you want to play? What's the easiest character to play? It's yourself. And that's something I love about it. I'm just playing, like I said, this amped up, turn to 11 version of kind of the jerky Chris Jericho, which there's still from time to time in real life. We all have that. But now I get to focus it on, really embrace it. It's a lot of fun.
The first episode of season two deals with a fictional show called Star Crusaders. Are you a really big sci-fi nerd?
I wouldn't say I'm a sci-fi nerd. I'm a Star Wars fan. I'm not a Star Wars fanatic, but I like Star Trek as well. I appreciate that genre. But it's funny because to be, you know, Star Crusaders, it's one of those series that you see like on the Sci-Fi Channel, which is like it's borderline awful and so cheesy to watch. And that's why I love the idea of doing that. Like El Chirico now has not even the lead role. He's like the fourth on the bill on this cheesy, you know, sci-fi show. And it kind of shows, you know, the progress between season one and season two. So season one was like 10 kind of bite-sized stories about this universe of that I'm Chris Jericho. Whereas season two, there's a story arc. You have to start it at season one, or start show one, and then go through to show six. And just having kind of the background of Star Crusaders, it's just great. We actually have, you know, like some special effects that for us are pretty damn good. But for the norm, they're not good, but that's okay because they're not supposed to be good. So it really fits. Like it's one of those things. I said this about season one, and I'll say it about season two. You can see this show on HBO. You can watch this show on CBC TV, you know, on Saturday night. It's, you know, right before Hockey Night in Canada. Like, it's so well produced, and the production values are so high, it fits right in with everything else. And that's what I love about it, is that we actually have this kind of cheap-ass B-level science fiction show that looks like a cheap-ass B-level science fiction show, and there's an art form to that. So I thought that was one of my favorite parts, just the ridiculousness of this set that Jericho has to survive and pretend that it's good. It's not good, but which fits the storyline.
Is that what you like about the genre of comedy? I mean, we're seeing in other cases how, you know, comedy has become a political voice, and, you know, a voice of social commentary. But what do you like about that genre in particular?
Not for me, you know, not for me. And that's the thing I love about comedy is it's so many things to so many different people. But I'm Chris Jericho. It's very broad. It goes from ethereal kind of Dennis Miller comedy to dick and fart jokes. And that's what I like about it. You know, I was never into the political comedy you see, you know, the opening sketch of Saturday Night Live or Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert. That sort of stuff doesn't really get to me. I like, you know, Fawlty Towers and The Office and Dumb and Dumber and Big Lebowski, which are all different forms of comedy. It can be, you know, preposterous and avant-garde, or it can be, you know, like I said, somebody farts in their face, ha ha ha. And we really appreciate all sides of that. Like, but I'm Chris Jericho is a very Canadian show, in that Canadian comedy is the best in the world. There's no doubt about it. You can go through the list of great Canadian comedians and Canadian movie stars. But the reason why it works is because there's a little bit of an English slant to it. You know, we're part of the Commonwealth. We all grew up, you know, in the 80s with the BBC, where you would see Fawlty Towers and Monty Python and Blackadder and the Goonies and that sort of thing. And then, you know, that kind of spurred off into SCTV and Kids in the Hall, which, you know, it's all Canadian comedy, but it's very funny, but there's always a little bit of a weird twist to it. And, I mean, a lot of SNL is that. You know, Lauren Michaels obviously is Canadian, too, so we appreciate that, and it goes, you know, right now Schitt's Creek is doing really good in the States because it's so different from what you see on, you know, Modern Family or, you know, Everybody Loves Raymond and those types of things. Those are more typical, traditional American comedy. Canadian always has a little bit of a weirdness to it. And that's what I love about I'm Chris Jericho is we have this very serious, you know, thing happening, and suddenly out of nowhere there's, you know, magic portal in a back alley that leads us to a weird producer's kind of drug den. And why not? There's magic in this world. because why wouldn't there be? You know, and I like that aspect where there's no limits to the comedy that we can do on our show because we're influenced by so many different types of comedy.
Are we going to see a season 3 of But I'm Chris Jericho? Do you know yet?
I would love to. I mean, that's one thing for me is that this is kind of like, it's the show that won't die. It's a concept that I came up with, I don't know, almost 10 years ago, longer, maybe 2005, 2006. And it took me 8 years to sell the show. 8 years from, I think, 2006 to 2013. That was when the first season came out. And then 4 years until we did the second season. So maybe in 2 years, we'll get to do a third season. You know, and I would do this show as my full time gig because it's so much fun, and there's no pressure. It's me, you know. So we write the scripts, and you know, you do the due diligence. But if you want to do a little improv, you do it. If you feel like changing something, you change it, and that's the beauty of it. We're all on the same page, and when you have people like Colin Mochrie and Kevin McDonald, and Scott Thompson, and Andy Kinler, these are all great improv comedians, anyways. We're going to roll with it no matter which direction you decide to take it into. So we don't have to be so rigid. And that's why the comedy works, because you can have five different takes with five different bits in it. Like, which one are you going to choose? Right. So I would love to do a season 3, and I'm really hoping that we get a chance to do that. Because coming back into this universe 4 years after season 1 was one of my favorite things I ever experienced in my career.
Another thing that you did recently was this boat cruise. Is there going to be another one of those in the future, or was that more of a one-and-done thing for you?
It hasn't happened yet. It's October 27th, 2018 is when we sail.
So, oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, boat cruise sounds like we're going, you know, through Lake Ontario or something. No, this is the Rock and Wrestling Ranger at Sea, where I took the two things that I love the most, which is rock and roll and wrestling, and put them onto a cruise ship. And we went on sale in September. Just had the biggest sales week of its existence this week. So people are really getting involved and really getting into it. And it's going to be a lot of fun. It's something that Fozzy played the Kiss Cruise a few years ago. As soon as I got off the Kiss Cruise, I said, I can do my own cruise. This is what I want to do. And, you know, had to have a team of engineers come on the boat to see if they could secure the ring to the deck, you know, all that sort of stuff. And things that you never think would happen when you're putting together a cruise, and stuff you have to realize, you know, ups and downs, trials and tribulations, stripes and gutters, but we got it up and running, and here we are, you know, still 9 months away and still selling in big numbers. So my mission is to sell this cruise out and make it an annual destination vacation based around rock and roll and wrestling. So far, so good, and I'm really excited about it. And, if you want more information, you can go to ChrisJerichoCruise.com and check it out.
Sounds good. Quickly, I know you said you grew up in Winnipeg. Are you into the Jets now, or is there another favorite hockey team that you have?
No, man, always the Jets. Yeah, absolutely. I'm not one of those guys that when the Jets move to Phoenix, when your girlfriend breaks up with you and moves to another city, you don't follow her and watch her bang her new boyfriend. You know, like, I was done with hockey when the Jets left, and I came back into the fall when the Jets came back, and they always have rough years, and we're used to it as Jets fans, but this year, there's a glimmer of hope. This could be their year, so, and the closer we get to the playoffs, the more of a frenzy there'll be, especially for Winnipeggers, man, and if they do make the playoffs, you're going to see the craziest fans ever at those playoff games, so, look forward to that. So go Jets.
And finally, what was the weirdest object you ever saw brought into the ring during a WWE fight?
Not so many weird ones during a WWE fight, but ECW fans used to come and bring like things for you to hit the guys with, like a Nintendo. Remember Nintendo 64 in the 90s? Someone brought their Nintendo 64. Someone brought a fishing net one time. Like, what are you supposed to do with this? Like, capture the guy and, you know, take him home, you know, put him in a bag or something. And I think there was times in the WWE, not any of my matches, when I think one time Kevin Nash grabbed Mad Dog Vachon's artificial leg and used that as a weapon. So for me, it was mostly just the meat potatoes of the chairs, the tables, and the fire extinguishers. Those are always fun. If you ever get hit in the face with a fire extinguisher, a spray in the face, make sure you close your eyes and close your mouth. Because I closed my eyes and didn't close my mouth, and the next 3 days, everything I ate felt cold, even if it was like, you know, the most caliente Mexican pepper, didn't matter because my throat was frozen from the fire extinguisher. So there's my advice to you as we leave.
All right.
If you ever get sprayed in the face with a fire extinguisher, eyes and mouth closed, please.
Well, the new season 2 of But I'm Chris Jericho Now is available for streaming on the CBC, or you can download the CBC app, and we look forward to your cruise in October. Chris Jericho, thanks so much for your time today, man.
Thanks, bro. We'll talk to you soon, man.
Alrighty, ciao. That was Chris Jericho. You can stream his TV series, But I'm Chris Jericho, on the CBC streaming site, watch.cbc.ca. Here is Fozzy with Painless.
Yeah.
Jennifer Petum is a documentary filmmaker. And if you watch her films, they're very imagistic. They have very powerful images and stunning cinematography. That's probably because she does a lot of, not nature, that's the wrong way to phrase it, but, you know, the natural world. In 2009, her documentary Solo won the Australian Film Institute Award for Best Documentary in Under 1 Hour. And in 2015, she had a very successful film called Sherpa, most of which was filmed during the 2014 Mount Everest avalanche. And that won the Grierson Award at the BFI London Film Festival as well. In 2016, it received the BAFTA nomination for Best Documentary. So you kind of get the picture of the style of films that that Jennifer makes. But even so, her latest, which some have argued is a spiritual sequel to Sherpa, is quite different, actually. It's a very unique. It's a collaboration with the Australian Chamber Orchestra. So not only are the visuals amazing, but it's got a fantastic score associated with it. And it's narrated by Willem Dafoe, which is pretty cool. This is actually the second person I've talked to who's made a documentary that's been narrated by Willem Dafoe. You may remember last year I spoke with a director back in September, called David Redman, who made a film about a sanctuary for donkeys that was also narrated by Dafoe. This is my conversation with Jennifer Petum and her new film, Mountain. Jennifer Petum, hello, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So you have a new documentary out, Mountain, and you've done a couple of these types of documentaries before. You did one in 2015 called Sherpa. What makes this film, how do we see mountains differently in this film than perhaps we have in some of your earlier work?
Yeah, look, this film is completely different. Sherpa was a really traditional documentary. I mean, it played at Toronto Film Festival at Hot Docs. I had an amazing screening there. I still remember it. Mountain is different in that it is right from the start, it's a collaboration. It was a collaboration with the Australian Chamber Orchestra. So they, in fact, commissioned this work. They're sort of known for their really innovative collaborations, and it was designed as a concert first and foremost. And so we kind of got together, and in fact we did some work together over in Niseko, Japan, where I am at the moment, where we did a lot of shooting and some of the editing over here kind of to be in the environment. But it was, it was the music in some cases drove the pictures, in other cases the pictures drove the music. It's a combination of original score by Richard Tognetti, who's the artistic director and lead violinist of the Australian Chamber Orchestra, but it's also... He helped me kind of pair some of the traditional classical works that appear in the film with particular scenes. So it's really a musically driven collaboration. But then fairly early in the work, I realised that we were going to need some kind of really, just some words, if you like, some poetry to kind of help drive the narrative a little bit more. And so I drew upon this amazing book that I had read when I was in my 20s, when I used to be climbing mountains, called Mountains of the Mind by the wonderful British writer Robert McFarlane. And I was over at the London Film Festival with Sherpa, and I approached him to see if he'd be interested in becoming another collaborator on the film. And to my delight, he said yes. And so, he also came on and kind of created this very sparse, very poetic narration script that kind of really explores the nature of our fascination with mountains, but also kind of helps to understand that this revolution in perception, if you like, so we've just 200 years ago, 300 years ago, we were, you know, the idea of setting out to climb a mountain would have been considered lunacy, you know, and here we are not very long later with a totally different relationship to mountains and extreme sports and all of these things. So it sort of explores that change as well. So it gives it some of its, albeit very dreamlike, it's some of its narrative spine.
You mentioned how it needed words, and you're actually the second documentary filmmaker I've talked to that has a film narrated by Willem Dafoe.
Willem Dafoe, yeah.
How did you get him involved, and why? What was it about him? Is there some tonal quality in his voice that you found fit in perfectly with sort of the rest of the picture?
It was partly that. In fact, I didn't know he had narrated this other film when I approached him to do ours. I kind of deliberated for a really long time. For a little while, Robert McFarlane, the British writer, was the voice. And he said to me, Jen, I really don't think this is going to work. My voice is never going to sustain, you know, stand up to the Australian Chamber Orchestra. I really think you should find someone with a stronger voice. And so then our temp narrator for quite a while was the wonderful, you know, principal cinematographer of this project and also my film Sherpa, Renan Ozturk, who's this amazing American cinematographer who's also one of the world's best climbers. And he was over in Niseko, Japan with us working, shooting, and I said, Nora, Renan, can you just, you know, just do this as a temp thing and I promise I'll find someone. But for ages I couldn't find anyone because there was so much authenticity to his particular voice, because really in many ways this was his story, you know, this idea of why do we risk our lives for this thing that cannot love us back, and it's something that he does almost every day. And so it took me ages and I was searching for a voice that, yes, was craggy and was like a mountain and was deep and powerful, but also that person needed to believe that you could see them on a mountain, and I really felt that about Willem Dafoe. I also felt that he would, as a really interesting collaborative risk-taking artist, which I think he is, I thought that the idea of this collaborative work would be interesting to him, and that was exactly what did appeal to him. He thought that we were taking a risk and doing something interesting. He really liked Robert McFarlane's words, first and foremost. I think he'd then seen Sherpa and liked that, and so decided that it was something he was happy to lend his amazing voice to, and it really is, it's like another instrument. So he became the next collaborator in the film. So really it is a big collaboration. It's not like a normal film, a very directorial, authorial kind of thing. It's you know, Renan and some of the other cinematographers, the local production company in Canada, Sherpa Cinema, were a major collaborator on the project, and they contributed some of their incredible footage. They're based out of Whistler, and so they became partners in the project as well. So it really is a quite a large collaboration. It took a number of years to kind of pull all of that together because of everybody's schedules. So it's an experiential film. It's not, don't expect to go to this film and get this really clear narrative with stakes and that kind of thing. It really is more of a poetic musing, and hopefully it's really immersive. Cinematography is, you know, is pretty mind-blowing, and thanks to all those amazing cinematographers. And, you know, so it is a very different kind of experience to Sherpa.
You know, how did that feel when you actually got to you know, meet and collaborate with Willem Dafoe? Because, you know, this here you are a climber and sort of nature filmmaker, and next thing you know, you're in the room with an Academy Award nominee.
Yeah. Look, I mean, my experience Willem is honestly is one of the nicest people I've ever met. I've just been exchanging emails with him over the last few days just to say, hey, well done on all of your nominations for the Florida project, which I have seen. If you haven't seen it, it's an amazing film. And he writes back and we're talking about collaborating again on another project. And he's just incredibly humble, and he's up. He's just up for the work. He's up for working. He's up for the experience of different kind of collaborations. He's interested in working, in pushing himself, in taking risks. And that had so many kind of parallels to this film, which was very much explores the nature of this kind of risk-taking. You know, there's a beautiful line in the film that says, for those who are enthralled by mountains, their wonder is beyond all dispute. For those who are not, their pull is a kind of madness, something like that. And it's their allure is a kind of madness. And it kind of speaks to the fact that, you know, there's those kind of people that will risk their lives to climb a mountain, and other people, you know, pretty much everyone else thinks those people are crazy. And I was interested in exploring the space in between, and so was Willem. He was really interested in that idea. He says he actually suffers vertigo when he gets on a bridge or a high place. He kind of has this compulsion to kind of step over the edge, yet it terrifies him. And I think he's just interested in the idea of being afraid and putting yourself into situations that make you feel frightened. And I kind of really relate to that. I mean, my own risk taking has been greatly tempered by the fact that I have two young children now, and I stopped climbing when that happened. They're 7 and 9 now. But, you know, I think our relationship to risk taking and risk, you know, and feeling alive is what it is to so many people is something that Willem relates to. And, you know, we had great conversations about that. And I mean, I was really nervous the first time I met him. We recorded the narration over in Rome, and but he just put me at ease straight away. He was incredibly respectful, talked about how much he loved the film, and when certain scenes would come up, he'd go, "Oh my God, I can't watch this." And, you know, he was really kind of, he was funny and he was fun and incredibly warm, and, you know, and it's just been a pleasure to work with. He came out to Australia for the world premiere, which was at the Sydney Opera House with a live performance by the Australian Chamber Orchestra, which was just an incredible experience. And to have him there, you know, with us was just amazing. So, yeah, I've got nothing but good things to say about Willem Dafoe.
What is it, do you think, that why have we become so obsessed with sort of mountains and climbing them? I mean, this is only a thing that we've been doing now for about 100 years or so.
Yeah. I think it's a complex thing, and I think the film goes into that. I mean, I think it's one of those things that, you know, before we climbed Everest in 1953, no one was sure that it was actually physically possible. And then each time you do something, you think, okay, well, that's possible. So then what's next? What's the higher, the fastest, the craziest? And I think there's a certain element in human nature, not everyone's human nature, but in human nature as a whole, you know, there's always going to be the risk takers. There's always going to be the people who, you know, need to push new frontiers. I feel like that's deeply embedded in our DNA somewhere, and it's part of, originally it was part of survival. Now survival is not such a big issue for those of us in the West, and so, but I think for many of us that compulsion hasn't gone away. And so in some ways, while I think on many levels some of the people and the pursuits they're doing in the film, you know, and throwing themselves off mountains and base jumping and all of this kind of stuff, and we see some pretty crazy stuff, although I think it's crazy and possibly reckless, I also kind of understand it. You know, scientists have identified a particular genetic disposition that they call the thrill seeker gene, and certain people have it much more than others. Basically, it's like a sliding scale, really. And I think those people just need higher levels of stimulation to feel alive. And in the case of mountaineers or base jumpers or mountain bikers or extreme skiers or this kind of thing, it manifests in that way. Look, in other parts of the population, it might manifest in a more negative, self-destructive way, you know, with drug taking and alcoholism and all of these kind of things. So I think it's all one and the same in some senses, and I just think we have a desire to find new experiences and try things that haven't been tried before. And while it's not something I necessarily want to do myself, I'm kind of really interested in those ideas. I've made lots of films over the years that seem to be around this space, and I'm interested in what drives people to do things, you know, that are risky, but also I'm interested in passionate you know, driven people who live their life on the edge, and extreme kind of people. So there's certainly lots of those in this film.
Edmund Hillary was obviously famously from New Zealand, and I've met a lot of Australian people that are, you know, skiers, jumpers, mountaineers. Eddie the Eagle comes to mind. What is the identifier and sort of the Australian sense of adventure? What is that to you?
Oh, that's a really good question. It's often, I hadn't really thought about that. I mean, one thing I can say is that Australians are one of the you know, most Australians and New Zealanders are kind of the biggest travellers in the world. You know, anywhere you go in the world, you'll find Australia and New Zealanders. It's like a rite of passage when we finish our high school. Most of us go overseas for a year and travel in Asia or Europe or South America, or, you know, I did all three of those things. I lived in, you know, South America for a year and then another year later on. Like, we just, I think we like to travel, I think, because by virtue of the fact we live so far away from anybody else, it takes us a long time. You know, I'm in Japan now. It took me 10 hours to get here. You know, to Europe, it's, or to LA, it's 13 hours. You know, a lot of Americans, they think of a flight that long and they don't want to get on it. But Canadians are pretty adventurous, aren't they? That's all my impression of Canadians, is that I often meet Canadians traveling as well.
Yes, we are an adventuresome people, more so, I think, than maybe our neighbors to the south. But
I think there's something similar actually in the Australian Canadian culture. I really had that sense a few times, even when visiting, but also when traveling, that there's this sense of, you know, not being of the mainstream.
Yeah, and of course, right now you're in the world's biggest metropolis, in Tokyo. Is that a different sense of adventure, just trying to navigate and get around in a place that big and that crowded?
It is, with two little kids, I can tell you. But they're loving it. No, it is. It's just, I find Japan so fascinating. It's just such a different culture. It's so, and it's so kind of stimulating. You think you've seen it all, and, you know, I've been to most parts of the world, but Japan is just so different and exciting for that reason. It's really thrilling, and it's really great to see it through my kids' eyes, who are just absolutely blown away. I mean, it's just so different, and there's you know, I've got Google Translate out the whole time because there's very little English text anywhere, but it's fun just exploring. We're off to see some ninja thing today and do some origami, and, you know, and then we're going up to Niseko to do some skiing. So I'm very fortunate.
Of course, Japan has some mountains of its own. A lot of people in Canada might be unfamiliar with that part of the world. What is the nature scene like over there?
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, that's one of the reasons we shot over in Japan. Some of the kind of resort and powder skiing stuff that appears in the film is from the shoot we did in Niseko, and it is, I mean, it's mind blowing. I've never seen. I mean, Australia, we do have ski slopes, believe it or not, in Australia, but there's just two of them really, and they're not that big. Two areas. Here I've never seen snow like this in my life. I mean, the powder is completely insane, and there were some Americans and Canadians when I was over there last time, and they said, oh, this is just far more than anything we've ever seen. So it is very unique in that sense. I mean, they have incredible mountains here. Everything has a different feel. The way that the snow falls to me just makes it feel like this magical fairyland, and so it just feels like you're in another place, in another era somehow. It's really a super new experience. And so we have some screenings actually of Mountain up there, which is why we're here. But I thought it would be great to come up and do some skiing with the family and see a little bit more of Japan. So it's that's a very special place, and they honour their mountains. And, you know, like in many parts of the world, like in the Himalayas and most parts of the world, the local cultures, you know, revere their mountains.
You mentioned that this film started as a collaboration with the orchestra, and music, I think, is such an important part of every film, but this film in particular. What was the process like in terms of trying to capture the right tones and sort of pairing the music with the images that are coming across.
Yeah, look, it was really difficult. It was a really difficult, experience because ultimately, you know, fabulous. Classical music, it had to work as a concert work for the Australian Chamber Orchestra, so there needed to be a certain number of traditional classical works. And let me tell you, there's a reason that more classical works don't appear in movies. You know, often in certain films you'll just get one big classical piece, but and then the rest of it is original score. It's really hard to pair because there were certain rules of engagement with the orchestra. We couldn't sort of fade out a piece of Beethoven partway through, you know, because you can't have the orchestra just fading it out in the middle of a concert. It had to work, and so, you know, what you discover very quickly is that these classical pieces go for a really long time, and the scene that at a certain point is outweighed its welcome, and you're thinking, oh God, can we just cut it there, you know? But so in the end, it was lots of kind of, I mean, I listened to everything the ACO had ever recorded, and in fact, one of the things we did in Nisiko was just try a whole lot of different pieces of music, and some of them really fit. You know, the Vivaldi that we have, I think two or three works of Vivaldi, they seem to just fit perfectly. They're beautiful to edit to, and it just felt right, you know. And in other cases, Richard might have suggested something. There's some incredible Arvo Pärt there that the minute, you know, in the Volcanic section, there's this, there's two Arvo Pärt works, which he's an incredible contemporary composer. And, you know, the minute I heard that music next to those images, I thought, that's it. And then it was a case of, I hope we can afford to license it, you know, for the film. Obviously, the ACO were going to perform it. So it was a sort of, it came to and fro, and then other places we just couldn't find something that fit or that worked. And often these were kind of bridging pieces. So about 50% of the film then is original composition by Richard Tongati, who was one of the composers on Master and Commander, Peter Weir's film. So he's, you know, also an experienced composer in his own right. So it was really kind of collaborative. It was a very respectful process. We had certain boundaries, you know, certain things I would just say, no, I don't like that. And you know, we've got quite different musical tastes. And one of the things that we discovered along the way is that when he started doing some of those original compositions, he would compose a piece of music and I would say, but why is it so kind of angry and frightened? And what I kind of, when I saw majesty and beauty, he would see terror and fear. And so that was something that we kind of had to reconcile, is that, you know, we were emotionally responding completely differently to the same images. And that possibly has to do with, you know, my years of being in the mountains and just finding them wondrous, amazing places, terrifying, but majesty and awe were kind of the words that I was using, and he was seeing terror and horror. So, and it was fun. It was kind of interesting to go, well, that's good to know that I can't presume everyone's going to see things the way I am and emotionally respond to them. And so it brought another layer of that collaboration. And in the end, the music that he composed in those certain sections, which are right towards the front, I think they're genius because they manage to kind of convey both those emotions. It kind of oscillates between the two, which is often what it's like to be on a mountain. It can be terrifying and it can be wondrous all at the same time, or usually in different moments, actually.
There was one headline from a, I think, a review that said, the film tries to critique adventure tourism but ends up glorifying that. Were you trying to say something specific with the film, and do you think sometimes we read too much into art to try and tell us things?
Yeah, it's always so interesting reading reviews because often people read into stuff that just wasn't there for you, but it's really interesting that they read that into it. Look, I think at once it is a critique. I don't think at any point I either criticise or glorify. I tried to stay really impartial. It was also something I tried to do when I was making Sherpa, just to try and sort of give a nod to or suggest to. Probably the most judgmental I become in the film is about the queues and traffic on Everest, which is something I do feel strongly about, because I don't see it as a kind of, you know, adventurous pursuit anymore. It's really just following a traffic jam up a mountain. So there is some judgment there, but in terms of these adventure sports. It was like I was saying earlier, I guess I try not to judge these people because I don't carry their particular DNA and I don't know what it is like to feel what they feel in their brains and their bodies and their emotional responses to things. I think we're all just trying to live life the best we can. And so, you know, we kind of, by editing things the way that you edit them, you can say certain things. And in some ways, you know, by cutting together a whole lot of just crazy lines of people and, you know, chairlifts taking people up and down mountains, you could take it as a criticism. You could also say, wow, look how popular this has become, you know. But I think, you know, it's an enthralling experience even watching some of this craziest stuff. And so some people might interpret that as glorification. Other people might interpret it as a criticism. It's, I think you take what you will, and it depends what your starting point is.
Defoe, I think Defoe at one point says that the Mountaineers are half in love with themselves and half in love with oblivion.
That's a great line, right? So that's actually directly from Robert McFarlane's beautiful book. And again, I think it's a line, we were talking about it, and he said after the book came out, that was the most commented on line in the book, and people continue to put it on Twitter and comment on it. And I think, again, what it means is open to interpretation. I think it is, there is a feeling when you're kind of living like that. And it's, you know, I think it's more commonly experienced in probably 18 to 25-year-old males, if you like, and some females, but possibly less so, that it is just this feeling of, I've just got to get out there and kind of live it. And you're of that age where you are very self-centered. You know, mountaineering is a very selfish pursuit. You know, it's expensive. It's, you know, takes you away from your families for long periods of time. It's dangerous. And I think it's thrilling all at the same time. And so I think people will read into that quote what they like. And that's what I love about it. It's take from it what you will. And it's a little bit about, I think I would say the same thing about the film. Going to mean different things to different people, for sure.
Well, the film is Mountain, and it opens January 12th, playing at Hot Docs here in Toronto. Jennifer Peetham, thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Great talking to you, and enjoy the film.
All right, enjoy Tokyo. Ciao.
Ciao.
That was my conversation with Jennifer Peetham about her new documentary, Mountain. That's it for the show today. Be sure to like it on Facebook, or you can download it on iTunes, Google Play, and TuneIn. And if you like what you hear, please consider donating to the show's Patreon page at patreon.com/endeavors. Taking out with Fozzie's Running with the Bulls. Thanks for listening. Ciao for now.